From the Sky News Centre at 6, Theresa May has thrown the European Union a challenge to improve on her Brexit plans after they were rejected by EU leaders. The Prime Minister says she expects a series of counter-proposals, insisting without them negotiations are at an impasse. But Shadow Brexit Secretary Keir Starmer is critical of her plan, which was drawn up by ministers at Chequers.
The Prime Minister's in denial. It was blindingly obvious that the Chequers proposal was not going to be agreed by the EU, and it won't be agreed by her own party. I'm surprised she's surprised at the situation we find ourselves in.
A woman who posted a video of her boyfriend dying in a pool of blood on social media has been jailed for 14 years. Fatima Khan plotted with another man to kill 18-year-old Khalid Safi. He was stabbed to death in West London in 2016. Seven men have been jailed after planning to bring migrants across the English Channel on jet skis. At least 18 Albanians were taken from near Calais to Kent in 2016. MPs are criticising NatWest and RBS after the group's customers were left locked out of mobile and internet banking services again. It says a technical glitch is now fixed, but the chair of a Commons committee claimed banks should stop closing branches if their online replacements are unreliable. Francesco Simonci runs a banking tech company.
The banks definitely they have to do a better job and improve, whether it's availability, whether it's user experience, whether it's convenience. But it's also true that our benchmark as consumers is getting higher and higher.
Last year's most popular baby names in England and Wales have been announced, with Oliver and Olivia topping the charts for the second year running. Leo entered the boys' top 10 for the first time. And Venice is considering banning cycling, swimming or being shirtless in parts of the city as it struggles with tourists. Officials are also looking at preventing excessive noise during siesta time. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
Yes, it is Friday, 6 o'clock, and I'm here for the politics show, sitting for Tony Gosling and helping me reviewing this week news. The Conservative councillor in Bristol City Council for Hembria and Braintree, Chris Windjuice, and as always, the All Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summer. For this week, yes, I'm Mohammed Makawi. As I said, sitting for Tony Gosling because he's away for this week in Holland, and he's going to be with us in the second hour at 7 o'clock, live through the Skype. And we're going and listen to an interview with Edward Snowden on
something
the star of the modern
people have concerns that are
journalist. Just started without even me.
If this is the case,
blame it. So let's start again.
Something in this system is not working. Clearly, people have concerns that are not unreasonable, but eminently reasonable. And if this is the case, if the public generally is concerned, if there is an unrelenting train of scandals about this system, if this were a system that were concerned about the public's trust, they would respond to these in a reasonable way. They would look at the criticisms, they would address the systems, instead of saying, any criticism of us is illegitimate, it's scaremongering, we just need to move forward. Now, anytime we're talking about protecting cheating on social benefits, right, it sounds like a good thing. Any company that asks for your ADR number for a service that the government is not paying for, if it is not directly funded by a social benefit and the company asks for it, they should not only be fined, right? Someone should go to jail for that. Because if not, we all know what's going to happen. eventually you're not going to be able to go to the store. You're not going to be able to sign up for a service. You're not going to be able to do anything in society without showing a number. You will be tracked. You will be monitored. You will be recorded in 100 different ways, and not by UDI, by the Aadhaar number that they created that then is abused by every other company, every other group in society. We have to ask ourselves, why do we have a privacy problem today? And the answer, of course, is because it benefits the people who are violating it. Think about it. If you had a neighbor who every time you left your house, they followed you around with a notebook, wrote down everything you did, and kept a record of it. And they did this for everyone in the neighborhood. The only way to change this is to work on two fronts. We need to use both technology to enforce our rights through things like strong encryption that companies and governments can't interfere with. So we protect our rights on the technical level. And then also on a legal level. This is a difficult challenge because it's very much an unfair fight. On one side, you have governments with spy agencies and armies. On the other side, you have companies with their billions. And on the public side, you have a few journalists working at newspapers that don't have very much money, right? But what they do have is the truth. And that's something that can't be changed, right? We need journalists in a free society, not to simply write down what the government says or what a company says and report that. That's not reporting. That's not investigation. That's note-taking, right? Instead, we need them to look critically at the activities of the most powerful members of society. We need them to work adversarially against these people and go, are they really telling the truth? And then find out what the truth is, and then tell the public that. Because this is how they become more powerful. The newspapers, fundamentally, should be a public service. But it's important to remember that newspapers can't work without sources. People inside these organizations, governments and companies, who are willing to talk to journalists, tell them where the truth is and where the lies are. If we don't have this, which is a real possibility in India without the efforts of groups like Amnesty International that are trying to create new whistleblower protections, we will run out of sources of information when the public needs them the most. I'm the president of a group called the Freedom of the Press Foundation. We take for granted a lot of times that newspapers will continue to happen. That we will have reporters, that we will always have people looking for the truth, right? But this is a hard job. It doesn't pay very well, and it's very risky. And there's no guarantee that this will continue. We see country after country facing a kind of new slide toward authoritarianism, even in the freest countries in the world. In the United States, we have Donald Trump as president, right? And we see the world moving towards, step by step, a sort of Chinese model. And this is a dangerous thing. And either that's going to be based on social power from people like sitting in this room who know what they believe in and are willing to stand up for it, are willing to risk something, are willing to dare to do the right thing despite the consequences. If we do this, if we make sure that those who interfere with the works of journalists are punished, and if we make sure those journalists who stand up and do reveal the truth at great cost, who are suddenly facing retaliation, do not face it alone, we can create a system of incentives, right? A blanket of safety that protects all of us by not focusing on individuals, but focusing on movements. By protecting values, by protecting rights, we can make sure that the next generation doesn't just enjoy the rights that we ourselves inherited that are coming under attack now. They actually enjoy more rights, new rights. Osama bin Laden, for example, stopped using a cell phone not when he saw some recent story in the newspaper. He stopped using it in 1998. And the question, of course, is why? The White House at the time said it was because, oh, newspapers were reporting too much information. But there were investigations into this, and it was found to be false. The actual reason he stopped using a cell phone was because he was at a terrorist training camp, and he made a call from his satellite phone on one day, and then a few hours later, a missile struck the hill he had made a call from. Terrorists may be evil, but they are not stupid, right? Terrorists will always know more than the public. And so this brings up the real question. When we see governments trying to deny the public access to information, when they try to punish whistleblowers and dry up the kind of journalistic sources that reporting relies on, are they really acting in the interest of public safety, or are they more concerned about political stability? Are they really worried about security from criticism rather than safety against attacks? But we should not live in a world where ordinary citizens have to live and act every day as if they are hunted by the world's most powerful sort of secret police. Instead, we need to think about what does a world look like where you don't have to hide from gadgets that you bought and paid for, right? And this is the problem. If you buy a phone and the government is pushing their phone numbers into your phone, if the government is trying to push identity cards into your phone that you have to show everywhere you go, every time you try to register for some service, you paid for the phone, but really someone else owns it. Someone else is deciding who uses it, how it's done, how it's tracked, who that information is available to. Does that sound right to you? And of course, the answer is no. When the people are afraid of government, there is tyranny. When the government is afraid of the people, there is liberty. The question we need to be asking today is, which of those two expressions is closer to what we see today? Am I safe? Right. And of course, I'm not. But if I were looking to live a safe life, I would still be sitting in Hawaii, in paradise, with the woman that I love, in a big house, making a lot of money for very little work, spying on all of you. Right? But there are always going to be moments in our life where we recognize we have a choice between doing the safe thing and the right thing. And sometimes the only moral decision is to break the law. I'm still a technologist today. I'm more of an activist than I ever expected to be. But the way I would describe it is I used to work for the government, and now I work for the public. Let's work together and let's change the world. I want to go back, and I intend to go back. But I will go back when my country is free, when the trials are fair, and when telling the truth is not considered a crime.
Yes, we are back. The Politics Show is Mohammed Makawi sitting for Tony Gosling with me in the studio. The counselor for Hembria and Braintree, Hembria and Braintree, Chris Windows, and in the other corner, always the old Oxford economist Martin Sommer. So we are back and we listen to Edward Snowden talking about
well, it's quite a long clip.
It is
from Edward there.
Yeah.
I believe he's in Russia now, isn't he?
He is. Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me about this, you know, the surveillance state that he's worried about.
Yeah.
Is that he walks out of the National Security Agency with one MP3 with the crown jewels of everything that they'd got.
Yeah.
So in other words, the surveillance state surveys everything and then somebody just hacks in at the top end and then they've collected everything that you've surveyed. Yeah. And of course, real spies don't necessarily use electronics all the time for that very reason. Yeah. It's actually a kind of a, you know, if you use too much electronics, you actually make yourself vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I understand the Russian secret services still use typewriters.
Yeah.
And card-filed indexes.
I think that's...
Because that's actually the way you do it,
yeah,
if you're serious.
That's what they call it now. I mean, it's a modern journalist, and, you know, everything is on the... on the web, in the internet.
Yeah, well, I think the Western intelligence services have concentrated far too much on what they call signals intelligence, and they've forgotten the old things of human intelligence. Yeah?
Yeah.
If you've got somebody at the top of an organisation, you can get much more information from them off the record than you're going to get by bugging their phone calls.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's much more difficult, but that's how spying should be done, yeah, basically.
And now they spy... at you by you logging in your phone and I mean your smartphone.
Well, in the past when they collected information on everybody, like CCTV and telephone calls and so on, they didn't have the technology to do anything with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now, of course, they've got computers which can go through and look for keywords and so on.
Yeah.
And that then pushed the whole thing towards more and more high-tech spying. But there's a big problem with high-tech spying. Snowden was a lowly level subcontractor to the NSA, and he just walks out of the building with everything that they've got because he can.
No one even...
He set off a crawler machine to look into what was going on, and then he collected it all. And then he just walked out of the building with everything.
Intelligent. So let's come back to Bristol in this topic. And so in Bristol, in the UK, as general, what are in the newsmen telling us? I mean,
this week, Well, in Bristol, we've got this question of the arena, which we thought we might discuss, because Chris here is if there's going to be an arena in North Bristol, it will be in your ward, Chris, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's quite right, yes. If, being the operative word.
Well, you abstained in the vote about whether it was going to go. What's all behind that?
Well, I don't normally think it's right to abstain. If you're an elected representative, then you should have an opinion. As far as I was concerned, I abstained because I couldn't see that either site was the right place for an arena.
Why that?
Basically because the one near Temple Meads, Temple Island, it's got very, very bad traffic problems.
Okay.
There could be problems with platform shut Temple Meads if that's if they have a big event. As far as the one at the Brabazon Hangar is concerned, the infrastructure around there is very, very poor at the moment. There's going to be approximately 7,000 extra houses built up there, which is going to add to the pressure on the roads. The Brabazon Hangar is not accessible currently from the A38 or directly from the motorway. It would all have to come through the centre, basically, of my ward.
So the people who don't know, I mean, where is that, side in Filton? Exactly where it is, people can... have an idea and picture of exactly where it is, the location.
Well, normally the border between Bristol City and South Gloss is the railway line.
Yeah.
But the Brabazon Hangar is still in Bristol, even though it's the other side of the railway line.
Yeah.
I do not know why that is. Mm. It's far, far above my pay grade to know things like that. I really don't know, but I do know it is in Bristol. I was a little bit amused, perhaps, at the full council meeting when there was a lot of discussion, when somebody stood up and said that it was a disgrace that the mayor was considering putting it in South Gloss. Unless we'd sold that to South Gloss meantime and nobody mentioned it to us, he was wrong.
So it's more accessible to South Gloucester resident than the Bristol resident, especially people who live in the central west or south of Bristol. So it's far away for them to go to. And as well, is for both sides is the pollution, the traffic is the main problem. And as you said, in Filton side, it's not even the it's not ready for anything yet, and it's far away from any main or major traffic route like a motorway or even an airport.
Well, the motorway is quite close by, but it's a difficulty when you come off the motorway of actually getting onto the proposed arena site.
Yeah.
You would have to come round right through my ward, and that would include negotiating Brentry Roundabout, Henbury Roundabout, by the Old Crow, which is a nightmare as it is.
And that will create traffic congestion in your area, and pollution as well, and so Martin.
Yeah, I was going to say they've built a lot of the Filton development on the old airfield up there. I mean, one of the things that was said the other week on here is that if this deal goes ahead, the council will provide all of the kind of transport infrastructure like buses and so on, but that's a bit the wrong, you know, because in other words that's actually helping the, because they built all that stuff up there without putting all that in, so this is a way of kind of smuggling it in, if you like. If we build the arena there, they can put transport infrastructure in for the arena, but we'll also help those, you know, the new developments up in that part of the woods. I mean, I'd like to hear what you feel about that. You know, is that a way? I mean, that seems to be the thinking of the mayor to me, that that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to do it on the cheap, basically, and try and kill two birds with one stone and so on.
I don't know what he's doing, really, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, a lot of people asking that question.
Yeah, I was in the public meeting. Like 10 days ago, and I think he's caring about the budget, the money, because it's going to be spent from the taxpayer money, and he want to cut down as much as he can, because he said the austerity and the Brexit and all of it. He wants somebody to come and build it and take care of it. That's what I get out of it. But are we going to get an arena, I mean, ever?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm not putting any money on it at the moment.
So
this project has been around for years and years, and the fundamental problems with it are to do with transport, whichever place you put it. Because Bristol's got a problem with transport. It always has had. And given my own view is, given the austerity that we're facing, which of course is to do with central government policy, which we can perhaps discuss in another, you know, in a minute. It's nothing to do with Bristol.
Yeah.
If we're going to close libraries and public toilets, why are we investing in arenas? You know, I mean, that's what my girlfriend says. I mean, if they're going to close the toilets in St. George's Park, why are we building an arena? I mean, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
So is it the arena that important? I mean, if we don't have it, because we'd be living without an arena. So can we live without an arena for, like, another 20 years or even 100 years? Is it going to make any big difference or boot Bristol on the map, I mean the world map, as you said?
I think people are more important than how important some people think Bristol is nationally and internationally. People who haven't got somewhere to live, people that haven't got a library that they can use and can't afford to buy books.
Having got a job, so many things, I mean, that's important to them than the arena.
Yeah, the youngsters that have had money withdrawn, funding withdrawn, all this sort of thing, and it's all very well to have a big arena.
Mm. Sorry about that.
somebody's off to the arena. I think it's quite right what you said, that there are more important things to spend the money on.
So I think the arena brings us to the main topic, which is being talking about and having done nothing about it for a long, long time, which is the traffic in Bristol.
Well, we've discussed that on this programme for 10 years and we've never come to any conclusion about that. If you think about it, it's objective. This is a medieval city built on hills.
Yeah.
And there was a tram system here. It was built by Sir George White back in the day, and it was ripped out in the 50s, was it? Was it in the 30s they ripped it out? It's a long time ago.
I think the system was ripped out before the Second World War, but they left a lot of the tracks in place, etc. I can remember riding my bike down through the cobbled street, which was Old Market Street, and catching my wheel in the...
Because even the tram system, it was proposed for like 10 years and it's been bust on for 10 years, and in the end it's the same fate as the arena. And they scrapped it in the end because I mean, that's about...
You need central government investment in something like that. When it was built in the first place, I think it probably was built by local enterprise, wasn't it?
Mm. Yes.
And of course, what happened is motorisation after the Second World War, everybody thought, well, everybody's going to have cars. Mm. And that was the mentality. Mm. And of course, eventually you realise, we've just crammed the roads full of cars and we don't want that anymore. But then you become path dependent. You've already, you've set off on a route and you can't go back. And so it's all very well saying we should have a tram system, but once you've scrapped it, it's a big thing to go back and try and rebuild it. Maybe you shouldn't have scrapped it in the first place, but once you've done it, you've done it.
Having said that, we've now got messed up, but I'm sorry, Metro bus.
messed up bus.
Perhaps I was right first time.
Yeah.
So, Filton Airfield.
We've got to finish that, the Metro bus thing. I mean, having wasted so much time and money on it, we've got to finish it now. Yeah. There's no point in doing anything else, is there?
Yeah, so the Metro bus, is it a good idea? Bad idea.
Ask me about Syria.
It's not loved by anybody, and it's taken years to do it. But once you've reached the point where you've spent years and years and spent millions of pounds on it, you've got to finish it.
300 and...
It'd be stupid not to finish it off now.
Something like this, if I remember. That's a lot of money to be spent in just making roads for the same bus, which is... already running.
Yes.
Yeah, so, but I don't know. Far be it from me to say
it's silly.
Yeah.
It was a halfway house thing, wasn't it? If they could get money for it, so they decided, if we can get money for it, we'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't really... I mean, this is the trouble. Everything we do in Bristol and elsewhere is we're just... we're bodging along, basically.
Yeah.
There isn't an overall plan.
Okay, let us move on. And Filton Airfield, all the engineers' jobs going to JKN and Rolls-Royce, all going to close.
Potentially.
So...
must be a lot of people in your ward who work in that sort of industry.
Yeah.
I mean, Mohammed, you're an engineer by training.
I used to work for the British Aerospace, which is Airbus, which is in Filton. And so, is that going to affect, the people who live in your ward and Bristol?
There's nowhere near as many people that work now in the aircraft industry as did do, say, in the 60s. When there were, I don't know how many up there, but there was more people working out there during the day than there was in Bristol. it could affect it. But I'm not going to say that I'm convinced with the scare stories. Let's be fair about this. I believe that governments and local governments like contentious things because contentious things and big arguments take away attention from what's really going on.
Yeah. Which is the Brexit or...
Which is what?
He calls it the B word.
Yeah.
I didn't say that. No, he said that. I never said that. I don't know what it means.
Okay.
I've never heard of it.
I'm not going to agree.
Well, obviously the issue there is Brexit going to affect the aerospace industry?
Yeah.
And I think it's definitely going to affect things like the car industry. That's pretty clear.
Yeah.
But of course, it's the just-in-time supply chains that are the really vulnerable thing here, because if it's got to cross the border, component has to cross a border several times before it's put into a plane or a car, that's going to cause potential problems if it's not straightforward.
So do you think we're going to get a deal. Brexit. Yeah, especially.
She should have gone armed.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you would be a fairly solid Brexiteer. Would I be right in suggesting that?
Well, if we go back to before the actual vote on the referendum, I spent a long time weighing up both sides of the argument. And I could see pluses and minuses on both sides of the argument.
Yeah.
What finally decided me to vote to leave was I didn't like the fact that the auditors had not been able to deal with the books for, I think it's now 17 years or maybe it's a bit more than that. Yeah. And I also didn't like the fact that we were being pushed into things that we didn't really want to do. And there was no real good reason for making us do it. And the people that were involved in making us do those things were not elected representatives. Okay. They were commissioners. And that is what finally decided me, enough is enough.
So
that was, well, I was a Remain voter, but I regard the situation now as like damage limitation, really. Yeah. We've got to just do something sensible. You know, the Norway option, I would suggest, because Norway has never joined the European Union. They had two referendums because they're actually in the single market. Yeah. And they accepted all the rules.
Yeah.
But they, and they said, well, why don't you join? And they voted twice, and they both voted not to join both times, just for almost sentimental reasons. You know, we don't want to be part of it.
But they got
but they are in every realistic sense part of it.
The rest of it is.
And one of the things about the referendum, there was nothing about the single market on the ballot paper.
So
you can leave the EU and still be in the single market like Norway is. So that would, I suggest, to my mind, that's the obvious solution to this problem we've got. Let's just buy a suit off the peg, and then we'll have to deal, you know, the problems that we face are big anyway, because the globalised economy is very difficult to establish any control over, whether you're in or out of the European Union.
Yeah, haven't got enough, only 190 days, I mean six months, I mean three quarter of the time is gone, I mean from the referendum.
Well, it is worrying. I'm thinking I may have to go over to Brussels myself and sort it out.
Yeah, well, I think that on the EU side, I think they're quite happy for the. We don't have to. It was Theresa May who triggered the Article 50. But of course, if she changed her mind or Britain changed its mind, we could say, well, we'll just extend the negotiation.
Okay.
This is fairly common in EU history.
All right.
You just carry on talking about it until you can sort something out. There's no reason to have a, you know, cut-off point, unless you want to have a cut-off point.
So she can
the British who've pushed for that.
She can ask
else
for
saying, why are you rushing?
So she can ask for an extension, after...
Well, I think that's what may happen in practical terms. If we can't come to any deal, the EU are going to say, right, well, we can't come to a deal. Let's just kick the can down the road a bit. Why not? It's fudge. I mean, basically, the EU is fudge. It's a great big pile of fudge.
So if she came back with no deal, do you think we need a people vote?
Well, it depends. You can only have another vote on something like that if there's a big swing in public opinion. And I think what's happened is that people who made their minds up, as Chris did, which way they were going to vote, very few people have changed their minds on either side, really. I think Remainers like me have probably accepted that we're probably leaving, but from our point of view, we just want it to be over with and as painless as possible. Let's just go for the easy option.
Because the debate now is getting bigger and bigger, and people say, like, you can see there is a sense of people asking for people vote, and the other side, they said, no, Brexit means Brexit.
Well, it's a big problem for the Labour leadership, because lots of Labour Party MPs want a second vote, but Corbyn's basically said, no, the vote's... That's it. We're not having a vote because it's been decided.
It's been decided.
But of course, Malta and the Czech Republic today were saying, well, why don't you have another vote?
Yeah.
I think the answer to that is, would it make any difference? If people are going to vote the same anyway, then there's not much point going through the process, is there?
Yeah, or even say to the Premier of Malta, well, why don't you give us free holidays for a couple of years?
The fact is other European countries have got their own problems. I mean, Malta is right in the middle of this refugee crisis, which is basically what most of the EU meetings are about. So, you know, the Brexit is really right at the bottom of the agenda because they're dealing with all this other stuff, you know.
Well, I think as well that Europeans are really playing extreme brinkmanship because at the end of the day, they really want this to work just like we do.
And
it's in their interest, just as in our interest, to have a good relationship and a good agreement. Because otherwise, it's just chaotic.
It's two-sided. I mean, because it cannot be one-sided. But I mean, the Europeans, they want to push for as much as they can get from there.
Well, I think the problem for them is if Britain gets a good deal, and of course it isn't, then the problem is everybody else is going to say we want some of that, and then of course that opens the floodgates. Norway, for example, has been part of the single market and not part of the European Union, as I mentioned earlier, and they don't get any opt-outs on anything, nothing. And of course, if Britain gets a better deal, they're going to say, "Hang on a minute, why? We've been doing this for 30 years. Why are you being so?" They've made trouble. It's a bit like the IRA in Ireland. We make a load of trouble and eventually they get what they want because they're troublemakers. Is that the way it's going to work? And of course the Irish border has turned out to be a big issue because the DUP are propping up the government at the minute and they don't want that to be brought onto the agenda. What the EU is suggesting at the minute is, well, we'll just the Northern Ireland, which voted to remain in the EU, should just remain in the single market. Again, that's a pretty straightforward proposition. That's what the Irish government want as well. But of course, the Brexiteers in the Tory party, they want to keep Northern Ireland 100% inside the UK. Makes me laugh because the Northern Ireland's got special rules about everything. So if they had special rules about Brexit, it would be no different from all the other special rules that they've got. But there you go.
How about Scotland?
Well, the Scots, but you see, if the Scots may then come forward and say, well, we want to have the same deal as they got. We want to stay in the single market. But I think the EU have already said that they won't countenance that. Ireland is a special case because you're trying to keep a potentially violent situation under control. Well, it's not the case with the Scots.
Okay. So let's move softly to international. How close is the crash between Iran and Israel?
As a councillor for Henbury and Brentry, how close is a clash between Iran and Israel?
Iran and Israel.
what's your view on that?
Well, my dad, who was in Iraq for most of the Second World War, he said to me when he came home, he said, "If there's another war, I can tell you exactly where it's going to start." That's where he said he was going to start. He's been gone many years, but I think he was right.
And that's where is all the war started and still continue. I mean, like in Iraq, Syria, and now, as you said, in Yemen. And so that area is really...
The potential for a clash is there. Obviously. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, the Israelis have basically been agitating for a war against Iran for the last 20 years. They've never made any secret of it. So that's what they want. The question is that what we want? And that's the issue for us, isn't it?
So now Trump,
Trump seems to be in the pocket of that policy. So we will have to see. To my mind, from a military point of view, it's suicide. You cannot attack a country like Iran and expect that you're going to win, because you won't. I mean, look at Iraq. I mean, that was a much weaker country, but it's turned into a huge headache. Iran has got much more serious armed forces. The Persian Gulf is in fact a death trap, as is the Mediterranean. I was reading this week that the Russians are thinking of putting a no-fly zone over the eastern Mediterranean. And if they do that, then all the NATO ships in the Mediterranean could be sunk. That's the issue.
That's right.
Because, Iran, China, Russia are not naval powers. They're land powers. And they've developed missiles which sink ships. It's the West that's dependent on aircraft carriers, which are basically old technology and can easily be got rid of. You know, one missile can sink a whole aircraft carrier.
Yeah. What bothers me is why Trump, he making peace with North Korea and making...
Well, I think he's making peace with North Iran. Korea, because if you're going to attack Iran, you don't want two wars on at once. And also, of course, the South Koreans are quite keen on sorting this out. I mean, they've run with the ball in the last couple of weeks. They've gone to visit the North Koreans and so on, because not necessarily the Americans aren't necessarily happy about that, but that's what's happening.
Well, I think most wars don't end up being won by anybody.
No.
Most wars end up in a terrible state for the people who don't take the decisions whether to go to war or not. And I think war is a terrible thing. Mm. And it should be avoided at all costs.
But there is some...
If somebody attacks you, then you have to defend yourself.
But some corporation and some, you know, they incited war for their own benefit. I mean, the big companies and, you know, the...
Well, my reading of the situation is that the big companies, and this includes people up at Filton, for example, supplying weaponry to BAE systems to fight in Yemen, and they've just got a deal to supply Typhoons to Qatar.
Yeah.
That's going to keep jobs in Lancashire, and of course the people in Lancashire want those jobs. They're high skilled jobs, they pay well, but at the same time, ultimately, what you're doing is providing weaponry to people who are going to use it, and at some point, most weapons do end up getting used. I mean, that's the reality.
Okay, let's move here back to Bristol. Our mayor Marvin Rees. And the Merchant Venture and the Slavery Memorial.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but they've just put a little plaque on the Colston statue, have they? Are you aware of this, Chris?
I have heard this sort of stuff that's going on about Edward Colston. I'd have no problem with that if we also... got rid of any reference to Romans, if we got any reference to all the other people that have invaded us over the past, including the Normans and the Anglo-Saxons. To me, you can't rewrite history. It happened. We don't agree now with the sort of thing that Colston made his money from, the slave trading.
Yeah.
But when he did that originally, it wasn't frowned upon. Mm. And you can't turn it back. I think there's a lot of silliness talked about the name Colston and the statue and things like that. Surely we've got more important things to worry about in our city.
But do you think we have to celebrate, somebody like him, and to have a statue and two roads and entertainment hall.
Well, as I understand it, the statue is going to be remaining there, but they're going to put a little plaque on it explaining, you know, that he was a slave trader, so that they can use it as a, you know, here he is, this is the guy. And then, and don't forget, the statue was only put up in the 1890s. It's not an original statue from the era.
I still think we've got more important things to concern ourselves about.
That's another point, isn't it?
Yeah. I really do. Yeah. Drive around the city today, walk around the city today, and you can find 1,001 things that are more important than putting a plaque on a statue or changing the name of a concert hall.
Yeah, but in the big picture, the slavery trade and Bristol involvement, then...
The schools do teach this stuff these days. Okay. Of course they do, as they should. You know, Bristol's prosperity was built on the slave trade. Mm. Nobody should deny that.
Yeah.
All the posh houses in Clifton were built on the back of it.
Mm.
And everybody should know that. There should be no hiding from that.
Yeah.
But we don't have to spend all of our time going back over it. We should just accept that that's the reality, and nobody should try to argue with that.
Okay, all right.
We can't change what was done. There's no way we can change.
Yeah, of course. But you will find, two sides in everything, side with against. So, they have the right to...
Well, those who want to change it can push to change it. When they took the Confederate statues down, which caused the fuss in Charlottesville, the local council had decided to remove the statues, which they were perfectly entitled to do if they wanted to do it. They voted on it, they decided to take them
that's
down.
That's exactly, yeah.
Yeah, now, if they decided to keep them, then they decided to keep them. But that's what they decided to do, and that was the decision. Okay. And some people didn't like that decision and they protested it, which again, they're entitled to do as long as they do it peacefully.
Okay.
But at the same time, all of this stuff has got still modern, you know, tension built into it, especially in the southern United States, you know, where black people only really got the vote in the 1960s. You know, it's still raw and painful. You know?
So in July, we had samples carnival. So do we have to bear for the carnival?
The council did put some money into the carnival, didn't they?
Yes,
because otherwise it's not really viable without some council support. But it was quite a successful carnival, I think. They were the biggest turnout ever.
Yeah.
And wasn't too much. There was a bit of trouble, but nothing serious.
Because it's been postponed for 1 year or two.
Well, it's postponed some years ago.
3 years,
Well, I was, for my pains, one of my duties is to sit on committees to decide on policy as far as all those sort of events which take place. The fringe ones that came before me to do with the carnival, but some of those were people that were trying to take advantage of the existence of the carnival, which was very good, and make money, but make it in a fashion which was unsafe.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And we stopped that, but we did support the carnival because it's a good thing.
Yeah.
And anything that makes people happy and enjoy themselves has got to be a good thing. There's too much misery in the world.
Yeah.
Let's have a bit more happiness.
And Bristol has been known by this carnival, especially during the summer, and around the year. So that's make Bristol different.
I think there were concerns about the people managing it being well-intentioned, but not necessarily competent to run it.
Yeah.
So the council then basically said, look, we're not saying we can't have a carnival.
Yeah.
We're just saying, and of course, what you they felt that it was being taken out of their hands and so on. But of course, the council saying, well, look, we're providing the resources here.
Yeah.
So we've got to, you know, you can't just say you can run it, but we're going to provide the money. And I think that's what caused a lot of the tension. And the same thing's happened with Notting Hill Carnival in London. It's become such a big event that the kind of ad hoc committees that used to run it is no longer really capable of managing such a huge event.
Yeah.
Mm. So, we move to education now. Bristol losing 1,000 teachers.
Sorry.
Bristol's losing 1,000 teachers. Yeah. Where do you get that from?
In the news.
I work in schools and I'm very well aware that schools are, you know, struggling to get the resources that they feel they need to do the job that they want to do. And it's the same with the whole austerity. Austerity has been going on now for quite a while, but of course it's taken
8 years.
Don't forget that the Tory government and Tory Liberal coalition initially said that they would bring the deficit down in one parliamentary term, which of course they couldn't do, and they actually lost the country's credit rating as the economy went down, and then they stopped doing it, and they've done it on more slowly, you know, basically at a slower rate.
Yeah.
And you can't actually cut a deficit much faster than that, even if you want to cut it.
Yeah.
And of course, if there's a further crash, you might not want to cut it because you need to prop the economy up.
Yeah.
This kind of macroeconomic stuff is not really. Most people are just fed up with austerity. They think they've suffered enough now, and now they want a bit of jam and a bit of fun. But the reality is that the banks are still insolvent, and most countries in the world are bankrupt. And we're going to see that coming through in the next year to 18 months, I feel.
Yeah, maybe 1,000. It's not in. I mean, this year, maybe for five years.
It's so hard to predict, Mohammed, because you don't know how much money they're prepared to print to put it off.
Because the city council, in their budget for this year, they cut how much?
Too much.
Too much. So that's exactly, I mean, well, that's affecting education.
Even aside the issues about austerity, the central government has dumped most of this onto local government because they know that that's not their responsibility and they won't get the blame for it. And that's, and I think across the spectrum in local government, people feel that they've been hard done by, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's true. I could agree with that. Unfortunately, the first thing that goes out of the window when people start trying to hang on to the money is common charity.
Yeah. So do you think Bristol City Council do Bristol credit?
Well, you better, I don't work for the council. Well, I did used to work for the council as
one
an officer.
One of you working for the council.
I don't do that anymore. We were saying before we went on air, Chris, you were saying there's partly a problem with funding. There's also partly a problem with the organisation of the council.
Yes.
Would you like to sort of expand on that a bit?
Yeah, but I think because of the pressure to save money, a lot of very good officers, experienced officers, left the council. They saw the writing on the wall. They left the council. And this is no reflection, of course, on the officers that exist now. I've come to know quite a few of them over the period of time that I've been a councillor. And they do a very hard job and work very hard. Unfortunately, some of those that are in a position of making the big decisions, they shouldn't be allowed to.
Yeah, okay.
Well, there's a big issue, isn't there, whether it's councillors or officers that actually run the show, isn't there?
I can assure you that it's not the councillors these days that run the show.
No.
So, do you think the Bristol City Council run the city like a business in some sense?
You can't run the council like a business. I ran my own businesses for 31 years.
Yeah.
You can't run a council like that because a business has to make a profit, whether it's for the individuals that are running it or whether it's for the shareholders. Yeah. Otherwise, they cease to exist. Mm. The local council has to take into account the needs and concerns of the people.
Yeah.
They can't make a profit.
Yeah. So I mean,
and if they are, they're cutting somebody else out.
Well, what we've seen over the last few years, of course, is that big companies like Capita and Carillion and so on taking over functions from the council.
Yeah. Yes.
But, of course, they have got a profit motive.
Yes.
And ultimately, with Carillion going bust and so on, then leaves everything in a total mess.
Yep.
It makes much more sense, to my mind, as a socialist, that the council should be a council, not a business.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So
I'll probably get in trouble now, but there we go.
Common sense. I mean, that used to be the general view when both of us were younger, wasn't it?
There
was the problem with bringing the private sector into public sector things is they're like oil and water or chalk and cheese. And the idea that we can't have a bit of private sector. Well, no, because the motive, what they're trying to do is different, you know.
They've got totally different priorities.
That's right. And that's what, if you've got a nice, clear division, so the private sector gets on with making money and doesn't bother about to itself too much about anything else, and the public sector doesn't do that, it does something else.
So
it's pretty obvious, really.
In the money, banks make it up out of nowhere or nowhere. And write off debts. Why can't the government do that?
That's a big topic.
Yeah.
What happened in 2008, 10 years ago this month, is the banks collapsed.
Mm.
And if you were going to follow a free market textbook, you just let them collapse. You know, we let the steel industry collapse. We let the coal industry collapse. You know, if it's not profitable, you let it go.
Mm.
And if the banks are not profitable, the free market economists that I read agree with this, and I've got sympathy with that.
Yeah.
Just let them go. But the problem with that is you then get into a downward spiral, which doesn't necessarily solve itself.
Yeah.
So you have to, as an emergency measure, prop it up. But that emergency measures have now gone on for 10 years. Mm. Yeah. Quantitative easing and so on was supposed to be for a couple of months while the banks sorted themselves out.
Okay.
10 years later, we're still doing it. Now, that can't be right by any definition.
Yeah.
And it's potentially really dangerous, actually.
It is dangerous, yeah. So, yeah, and we came to our last 4 minutes in our first hour with the councillor for Hembury and Braintree, or Braintree and Hembury.
How many hundred years are you going to carry on, Chris, in your council role? Yeah.
Well, the people love me.
Yeah,
good.
I keep telling myself that.
How long have you been in?
It's not up to me. It's up to the people.
No, how long you've been running as a councillor?
This is coming up 10 years.
Good, good, good.
I was a councillor in North Somerset many years ago. Mm. We can't really count that.
Mm. And I don't. There's going to be an all out election in two years' time. So are you going to stand it? Is it two or three?
Oh yeah, I'm going to. It's 2020. Yeah, May 2020.
So
yeah,
are you going to stand again?
Yes, of course I am. Yeah, I know I look old, but it's just because I work so hard.
Look old.
And since it's radio, so nobody can see that.
Oh no, good job, probably.
As long as you're. I mean, what, the people love you and you do.
No, I tell myself that the people love me. Yeah. I'd like to think it was
true. If they
true,
don't love you, they don't vote you again and again. So
it would be councillor for life.
Yeah.
That'd be the day.
Yeah. So, yeah, and we will say thank you to you.
Cool.
And we'll be, after the 7 o'clock news, going to Holland.
Live to Holland to pick up with the boss.
Yeah, with the boss from there. So stay tuned, and we're going to listen to sing a song if you've got time for that. Or so if you have anything to say.
Just like to say thank you very much for giving me some air time, and thank you very much for those people who didn't switch off.
Well, those who switched off, they won't even know, will they?
No, that's very true.
No, we had a good time, and we hope to see you again and again in the program.
Well, if he's going to stand in 2020, he's going to be coming back again and again, isn't he?
Yes, probably. Hopefully.
So, the 7 o'clock Mordek News, and we'll be back after that. So, stay tuned to BCFM and all our show, and I will be back with you after 8 Arabian Night and Salam Africa. Muhammad Makkah with you. So
this is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.